It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Dozens of Wisconsin National Guard soldiers were deployed late last year to U.S. Central Command in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. That's a joint military task force to reduce the threat of the Islamic State terrorist group, better known as ISIS. We will discuss this mission and we'll check in on other activities in the Wisconsin National Guard with Brigadier General David May, who joins us now. He serves as Interim Adjutant General for Wisconsin's National Guard and is responsible for emergency management in the State Department of Military Affairs. He also leads the state's Office of Emergency Communications. General May, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So more than 60 Wisconsin National Guard soldiers with the 732nd Command Sustainment Support Battalion, they were called up to active duty just over 5 weeks ago. Can you update us on their mission?
I can't get into a whole lot of detail, but I can certainly report that they're doing well. And we have a number of other units, primarily Army National Guard units, deployed as well in similar areas. And to date, they're all doing extremely well, settled into their new mission, transferring from, you know, the departing unit to them. We keep pretty close track of them, and we'll have probably some visitors from the senior leader team here go and check in on them in person later this year.
Later this year. And U.S. Central Command being in Florida, have these soldiers been sent then overseas as part of this deployment?
Our soldiers are overseas, correct.
Yeah. You know, can you talk a little bit more about Operation Inherent Resolve and this mission to weaken ISIS? How are our soldiers involved in this? And can you talk more about the mission?
Sure. I can talk at a general level. The primary thing of importance right now is that the U.S. maintain a presence in that particular area of operations. It gives support to our partners and our allies and to potential aggressors, as you've mentioned. It shows them that we have a resolve to maintain a presence in that area and keep things going in the right direction. Our soldiers play a key role in that, whether it's day-to-day sustainment missions or as things change in the theater and they get called into more emerging or more active missions. But they're there to support whatever needs to be done. And of course, they're taking direction from active duty leadership in charge of that operation.
And I know you want to talk at a more general level here, but there's been reporting from Air and Space Forces magazine that the U.S. is trying to prevent ISIS militants from exploiting the situation in Syria after former President Bashar al-Assad fled the country and his brutal regime has fallen. How big of a threat is ISIS to Syria right now?
That is a very big and loaded question. And I'm not in a position really to give you much of an assessment on that. Are we concerned about it? Absolutely. And as I said, maintaining a presence in that part of the world so that we have capacity to respond to things as it develops is the key thing for the National Guard. We serve as the primary combat reserve to the Army and the Air Force. And that's exactly what we're doing right now with the Army, is providing our soldiers who are very skilled, very experienced over there, so that they can roll in and help with whatever the chain of command there sees as needing to be done.
With Operation Inherent Resolve laser focused on weakening ISIS, it's hard not to look to our soil here, the man the FBI identified as the perpetrator of the New Year's Day terrorist attack in New Orleans, claimed alignment with ISIS, had a U.S. military career in the Army. How are you reflecting on this burst of violence in an American city?
Well, like everyone, it's concerning to me individually and concerning to me as a military professional. ISIS is as much an idea as it is an organization, and defeating an idea that doesn't necessarily need a conventional structure behind it is really hard. And I think for years we've acknowledged that homegrown violent extremists are potentially the biggest terrorist challenge that we have, because detection is so difficult. The FBI works tirelessly on making sure that we detect as many possible threats that are out there, but this is a really complicated and difficult challenge.
We are talking about Wisconsin National Guard, current missions, deployments. We have General David May with us, Interim Adjutant General for Wisconsin National Guard. Another deployment in September, around 10 Guard soldiers were deployed to Horn of Africa, their mission of the U.S. Africa Command to strengthen the defense capabilities of African countries. What threats are soldiers hoping to address in this area? Can you update us on this deployment?
So not unlike the Central Command mission, this is very much a presence mission as well. And it's about supporting partners and allies and maintaining some capability there as we grow our relationships in Africa. It's essential that we have forces there that can partner with the various countries in the Horn of Africa. And having been there much earlier in my career, I can tell you that's really, really important and gratifying work to be done. And there's a lot of potential there, but we've got to be there physically to have an impact, because there are other countries like China that are also trying to do the same thing, just in a very different manner. So having an alternative type of relationship for these countries with the U.S. is really important, and our soldiers are supporting that.
May I ask what your work was like earlier in your career in your deployments in Africa?
So I was in the active duty Air Force at that time. This was about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And our presence in the Horn of Africa was relatively new. And at that time, we were very much focused on creating military-to-military partnerships with really all of the countries to different degrees in the Horn of Africa for training, for logistics support. We did a lot of civil affairs type work in terms of building schools and helping dig wells and things like that. Really, really partnership building as opposed to actual war fighting.
You've had a long career, decades in the military. And I want to talk a little here about recruitment. The U.S. Department of Defense says only 23% of people between age 17 and 24 even qualify to join the military, and it can be due to medical conditions. It can be due to criminal background, other things. Does the Wisconsin National Guard have challenges in recruiting soldiers?
We do. We share the challenge with really all components of the military. In the Air and Army National Guard here in Wisconsin. And things really changed during COVID. I think the understanding of what the military does changed a little bit. I think society changed a little bit, and the way young people consider their options changed. And we're having to adjust to that, because I still think there are plenty of young people out there that are interested. They just don't know enough about the Guard. And the Guard is full of just enormous opportunities. But we are having a challenge, and we are starting to see improvements, modest improvements this year, as we continue to try different ways to engage with that younger recruitable population. Though I'll add, we actually accept recruits up to age 42. So it's not just necessarily young people. There are a fair amount of people that decide to start a career with us a little bit later in life.
The Army National Guard Recruiting and Retention Battalion has cited a culture of trust, accountability, and a winning culture. Is there a particular strategy that has been successful to increase recruitment?
We have, like I said, we've changed how we communicate and talk about our opportunities with young people.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that they understand that while it is just educational benefits, there are also opportunities for travel. Retirement benefits are significant. We have part-time and full-time employment opportunities that can work well with someone who wants to go to college or go back to grad school or start a small business. Our guard population does a variety of things. We have business people, farmers, teachers, every walk of life represented here in our full and our part-time force. And that kind of flexibility to serve here in Wisconsin and to get all those experiences is the story that we're telling. Because very often people think about service in the military, they think, well, I'm going to have to go somewhere and I'm not going to get to decide what I get to do and when I get to do it. And I'll be restricted to this certain set of circumstances. That's really not the case with the Guard. We provide a different and I would say bigger set of options for people to develop in their own lives and reach their goals along with military service in a way that you're not going to find in the active duty or the reserve component.
I want to land here in our last minute together. You have called the National Guard's Office of Complex Investigations assessment for sexual assault complaints and harassment complaints a roadmap for preventing sexual assault in the Wisconsin National Guard. What are you doing to change the culture inside the Guard?
So that assessment came out in 2019, and I can report that we have made significant progress since then. I believe we have a much better program at this point, and we have built trust. We've improved our processes. We've improved our accountability, and the program that we have in place now is dramatically improved from where we were at in 2019. And we see it in the cases that we manage. We see it in the development of our staff members that support the program. And I would say we're probably one of the leading programs in the 54 National Guard organizations today.
General May, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Great talking to you.
You too. That was Brigadier General David May, who serves as the interim adjutant general for Wisconsin's National Guard, giving an update on current deployments and missions of the Guard. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, UW-Madison psychiatric researchers are making new discoveries about how childhood trauma affects mental health later in life.
We did not expect to find that certain types of trauma would actually be associated with a reduction in psychiatric problems long term among some of these kids.
That conversation is just ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Institutes of Health is in the middle of conducting the largest long-term study of childhood health in the U.S., and UW-Madison psychiatric researchers are examining the data from more than 11,000 children who are participating in the study. To date, they've made some surprising discoveries about how childhood trauma affects mental health later in life. They recently found evidence to suggest that the type of trauma a child experiences could be more impactful than the sheer amount of trauma they encounter. We're joined by a lead researcher on this study. Justin Russell is research assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Justin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here.
You have been analyzing data on this long-term study, 10-year study. What are you trying to understand about traumatic events in children's lives?
Sure. So the study that we're actually working with, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, it's the largest study of kids' brain development and behavioral development ever undertaken in the U.S. And what they do is they share the data with lots of different researchers. It's such a massive study. So we've been able to get our hands on the data from the first 4 years, starting when these kids were 9 or 10 years old, and through about 13, 14.
And, in terms of what you're looking at here, we might be familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire, the ACEs questionnaire that's used maybe in the pediatrician's office, used by clinicians to learn about these traumatic events in a child's life. How does your study intersect with the ACEs score?
I'm really glad you mentioned the ACEs. It's actually that screener that, maybe 15 items, a lot of people have taken it. And it asks you about different, bad things that might have happened in your childhood. For example, were you exposed to, violence, or did, one of your parents have a drinking problem, all sorts of different things. It's a list of about 15 items, and you sum up the number of items that you've been exposed to or the things you've experienced, and you get this ACEs score. And back in the 90s, and even, continuing today, we found that that score is hugely predictive of later mental and physical health problems all the way into adulthood. Well, unfortunately, one of the things we also found is that it's not predictive of any one single problem. So you can't take that score to a doctor and say, hey, I've got an ACEs score of 3, and the doctor will say, okay, well, you're probably going to be at risk for A, B, C, and D. So one of the things that we wanted to understand is where is the kind of the ACEs approach, that ACEs screener really kind of assumes that it's the total bulk of things that happen to you. We want to know, does it really matter what different things happen to you? And if you're exposed to different types of trauma or adversity, do you end up with different outcomes? So one of my biggest focus as a researcher has always been trying to understand why kids who get exposed to adversity or trauma early in life can end up with so many different types of problems. You could have one kid who's really resilient and, really excels at sports, school, everything, what have you. Another kid who's severely anxious, maybe even refuses to go to school. And yet another kid who's constantly suspended and getting in trouble and difficult to control in the classroom. So really, that's how this started. We wanted to kind of branch, build off of the what we understand from the ACEs work. And see, okay, well, are different forms of trauma really going to be predictive of different outcomes?
So, in terms with ACEs, tabulating the quantity of trauma that a child faces, that you're really trying to dissect particular types of trauma and see what those outcomes might be like later in life?
That's exactly right. So it's kind of strange to think about, knowing what we know about today and how much of a focus there is on the horrific things that children can go through as they're developing. But the idea that early life experiences could really affect us for life, it's actually a pretty novel idea in medicine and in psychiatry and psychology. I really only started to become a bigger and bigger deal in the mid-90s, where we started to understand the long-term outcomes. And like I said, that ACEs instrument, that ACEs questionnaire really just kind of takes a total sum of how many bad things have happened to you. And it's been a real major public health achievement, in helping disseminate knowledge and helping broaden people's knowledge, of the importance of considering, childhood trauma and adversity. But now we want to kind of build off of it and see, well, okay, is it more than just the sum? Is it more than just, the total number of problems? Is it really the case that, what actually individually happens to us matters?
Your research group, though, was surprised. You were expecting to see that negative impacts in the kids, regardless of the type of trauma they experienced, but you found something different occurred. What is enlightening here?
Well, it's intuitive, right? I mean, that's kind of how we started, the idea that, well, when bad things happen to kids, they should be, universally associated with bad outcomes, with mental health problems in the future. But maybe, depending on the different outcome or, the severity of the experience, they might be all, different types of experiences might have different strengths of effect on, on future outcomes. However, what we did not expect to find was that certain types of trauma would actually be associated with a reduction in psychiatric problems long term among some of these kids. So we kind of split the way we looked at mental health problems into two different groups. We looked at internalizing problems, so problems that tend to be focused on the internal, the self, anxiety, depression, versus externalizing problems where, your behavior is manifested outwards, and these kids are often disruptive, and we associate disorders like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or oppositional defiance disorder, those kind of outward behaviors we call externalizing. And we kind of looked at how those two types of disorders, the two groups of disorders, changed over the next 4 years. And it was really stunning to us that among kids who had certain types of exposure, the highest levels of exposure to certain types of trauma and adversity, they actually declined in their rate of those problems over time.
What were those certain types of adversity?
Sure. So I'll back up a second. From the adolescent brain and cognitive development study, they asked a ton of questions of these kids. And what we did was we went through every single question that they had asked them, and we picked out 268 of them that really kind of asked the kids or their caregivers about an objectively negative or harmful event in a kid's life, something that we'd all assume is just kind of universally bad. And we were able to kind of group those together and distill them and find how, how they co-occurred and how they hung together into eight different forms of adversities: community threat, peer aggression, so bullying, caregiver maladjustment, like does your parent have a drinking problem? Do they have a hard time holding down a job? Are they constantly in trouble with law enforcement, chronic pain or medical problems, discrimination, family conflict, not just between the parents, but all, between siblings, between parents and siblings, poverty, and then exposure to interpersonal violence. And I'll give you an example. Community threat, experiencing a lot of violence or, in your community, at the highest levels of that, at the kids who were exposed to the most threat, they actually showed a decline in internalizing problems as they got older. And that didn't make any sense to us when we first saw it. The idea that kids who live in a really threatening environment would experience any reduction in mental health problems is really stunning.
How might a child's development of resilience and their development of grit factor into these findings?
Well, we think that what's actually happening here is not that they're not that these kids may necessarily be thriving. We don't think that we've picked out just the resilient kids, but what they're actually doing is adapting to their environment in ways that what they still carry the burden of mental illness, but because of the context that they're living in, because of the environments these kids are living in, they have to kind of change the way they show it. So, for example, if you're living in a really threatening environment in a really dangerous community, it might not be very helpful for you to be showing a lot of symptoms of worry, anxiety, depression. So you might actually kind of suppress those. That's one theory we have. It might also be just that exposure to different types of trauma and adverse childhood experiences kind of shifts the timeline for when you're most at risk of different types of mental health problems. We're just not sure yet.
We're discussing this long-term study, investigating the effects of different types of childhood trauma on kids as they grow up. And we're with Justin Russell, a research assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So, Justin, I want to turn now to how might policymakers be able to use the results that you're learning so far to change the way they address traumatic experiences of the children who are in the community?
I think that's a great question, Kate. And that's really one of the takeaways of this. I think that if I'm a policymaker, I'm probably often frustrated with psychology and psychiatry and research, because we generally kind of say that bad things happening to kids is bad, and it's going to cause bad outcomes. But that doesn't really tell us, well, which things are the worst? Where do we put our policy dollars? Where do we put our investment dollars to try to improve outcomes in our communities? And these results might suggest to policymakers that, you can get the most bang for your buck in terms of, in terms of positive outcomes and effects if we try to prevent, exposure to certain types of trauma or adversity, or we work hard to ameliorate the effects of those certain types of trauma and adversity, like, say, family conflict or peer aggression. If we really put our efforts into trying to mitigate those problems, we'll see the biggest outcomes in terms of benefit for our kids.
Do you anticipate that clinicians will use the ACEs questionnaire differently in the future?
I'm not sure. The ACEs questionnaire is wildly popular, and for good reason. It's really, like I said, it's really been associated with a monumental public health achievement in making the country and really the whole world aware of how bad things can affect in childhood, bad experiences can affect us long term. It's actually now mandated that every kid who sees a pediatrician in the states of at least Vermont and California, I believe, are going to be required to complete that questionnaire at least once. I think that what I'd like to see clinicians do is maybe consider the ACEs as just one piece of a broader body of information that we can get about these kids. That it's not the end all be all to know how, just how much bad stuff a kid's experienced, but we really need to understand the individual person and their experiences. Because the different types of things that we've been through and endured really do matter in our outcomes.
When you look at this data, are you relying on the kids themselves to recognize their own symptoms? I mean, how do you take that into account when you are looking at what you collect here?
Sure. Yeah. Any clinician will probably tell you that it can be very difficult, especially as these kids get older. You can kind of get conflicting information from parents and from kids. We actually used reports from both in terms of determining what was going on, what kind of adversity these kids were exposed to and what they weren't. I think that going forward, in younger kids, it can often be parents who are really better at telling you what's going on with the kids in terms of mental health problems. As they get older, though, the parents are, they're not really as great as the kids at telling you what's going on. That's been a longstanding challenge in kind of trying to understand how mental health problems develop or change shape or presentation or, how these problems become more or less severe as kids get older. Definitely tricky.
So here you are. You've studied kids starting at the age of 9 or 10. They're now teenagers. They're either entering high school or in high school. The study is continuing, well on till they're out of high school, 19, 20. What will you be watching for and looking at as these kids grow up?
Well, I think one of the first things I want to know is do these trends that we've identified here continue? If I, for example, especially in the cases where certain forms of exposure to certain forms of trauma or adversity predicted a decrease in mental health problems, does that stay the same as these kids go into the later teenage years and even into early adulthood? Or is there more of a shift? Is this just a, is this finding just a result of when we looked at these kids, or is it going to extend as they get older? That's the first thing that I really want to know about. I also think it's really, really interesting and, of course, really important to just understand the way that adversity and trauma can affect kids when they're teenagers and they're going through so much stress, and so much rapid development of their brain and their body, their social lives, their relationships with the outside world. I'm really looking forward to the data coming out about that.
I wonder, will you be able to know or track whether any interventions are helping these children?
Ooh, I wish we could, but this with the ABCD study, it's purely kind of a study of how these kids are developing. However, our research group is actually conducting alternative work, looking at lots of different ways that we can kind of take our knowledge about trauma and the different types of trauma and plug it into interventions or preventative efforts, specifically those that kind of meet kids where they're at. It can be really hard to get kids into a therapist's office. It can, especially those kids who are marginalized and, more impoverished. And we're trying to find new ways of intervening with kids that use things that kids are already doing, like video games and virtual reality, and finding ways that we can kind of take those treatments that we know work and integrate them into the things kids are already using. So we won't know anything from the ABCD study, but we can use the knowledge that we've gained here in work that we do closer to home and in the community around us to try to find what's going to work best.
And teachers and counselors and other support members in schools might want also to know what can they do better to help the children through these harmful experiences or to support kids who are in the throes of something really harmful.
Oh, I think that's such a timely question. I'm really glad you asked it. I think understanding for kids, first of all, that every kid is different. There's no uniform pattern. Every kid's experience is different. Kids are susceptible to a lot of different types of trauma, and we can all be affected very, very differently. I think that we should consider the kid before we consider the experience. And I think it's important to kind of be able to vary your approach and really think about who this kid is and what their strengths are and how they can we can push them towards resilience. And I think that that's really something a lot of our community is talking about right now. And I really believe that understanding how kids are experiencing things individually is really the way to go.
Justin, thank you so much for sharing your research. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's been great to be with you.
That is Justin Russell, who is a research assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked with him about his new study investigating the effects of different types of childhood trauma on kids as they grow up. The study was published this month in JAMA Psychiatry. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, we meet the Wisconsin printmaker whose art celebrates the work of migrant laborers like her father.
Well, these early observations really shaped my understanding of labor and inequality and resilience, driving me to honor these stories through my work.
The art of social justice, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Printmaking is an art form that involves applying ink onto a surface using a variety of techniques that are both ancient and modern. The earliest printmaking processes have their roots in China, where artists would use woodblock prints on silk. Today, one of the premier printmaking programs in the country is housed at UW-Madison. It's easy to think of a computer printer, which can print things quickly and seemingly without any effort. But other forms of printmaking are labor-intensive, requiring an artist to carve into wood or other materials and work with heavy, large equipment. One printmaking artist in Wisconsin believes that printmaking can be a tool for social justice and storytelling about migrant workers. Christy Tirado is a Mexican-American interdisciplinary artist and educator who specializes in printmaking. She's currently enrolled in the MFA printmaking program at UW-Madison, and she spoke yesterday with Lee Rayburn about her work.
Now, before you came to Wisconsin for the MFA program at UW-Madison, you spent nearly a decade in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. Tell me a little bit about how your time there inspired you to tell the stories of migrant laborers and do it through your art.
Yeah, so before coming here to Madison, I was living in Yakima, Washington, and I was an art educator there for about 8 years. And working in an agricultural town with nearly 50% Latina Hispanic people, I realized that there was a lack of visibility within this migrant community and the labor work that goes into carrying out, everyday agricultural labor in regards to picking cherries, the hops that go into our beer, the grapes. And what I started doing is started going into the fields and interviewing some of these individuals and really getting those stories and those narratives and get a feel for the work that goes into, you know, sustaining our economy and rendering visibility to these stories that largely go unheard and also unseen.
So as you explore the identities and experiences of these migrant laborers, tell me a little bit more about their experiences and how it resonated with you, Christy.
Yeah, so the focus on their labor, I would start off with it being deeply personal, rooted in my own upbringing and the experiences of my parents. So being the daughter of Mexican immigrants, I witnessed my parents work tirelessly, often juggling multiple jobs, just trying to make ends meet. And their work, which was, you know, not necessarily always tied to agriculture, you know, it went from washing dishes to sewing garments to laying down concrete, for me was undeniably essential. And yet, you know, they were treated as invisible or insignificant in these different jobs that they had. So these early observations really shaped my understanding of labor and inequality and resilience, driving me to honor these stories through my work. So when I arrived to Yakima, I noticed there was that repetitiveness, like that was happening in my life with being able to see that reflected in these Latina communities. And I really wanted to bring these stories to light and really honor them the way that they should be.
So you're now in Wisconsin, and how has that shifted your focus and your work?
Yeah, so right now I'm doing my MFA in printmaking, and I just feel really fortunate to be a part of this program because not only is it giving me, you know, helping me gain new skills and different approaches, different perspectives to printmaking in general, but it's also allowing for me to dig deep into my own familial histories and stories and be able to translate that into new bodies of work.
So let's talk a little bit about printmaking here, Christy, and let's start with the basics. What kind of artistic methods and tools are used under the umbrella of printmaking?
Yes, so there's a lot. So I'll just start off with what is printmaking. So I would say printmaking is an artistic process where there's an image or design that's created onto a surface, like either a wood block or a metal plate or a screen, and then it's transferred onto another material. It can be, you know, pressed onto a material like paper or fabric. It can be squeegeed on, like if it's screen printing. And it's what makes printmaking unique is its ability to produce multiple originals, also known as editions, which allows art to be more widely shared and accessible. So unlike a painting that's, you know, one of a kind, you can create multiples with print, and they're also originals.
And what's the power in that, being able to make reproductions and copies?
I'm particularly drawn to, I guess, printmaking and, you know, the copies that you can make because it allows for the creation, like I said, of multiples, making it an ideal medium for amplifying stories that deserve to be widely seen, especially those of immigrant and marginalized communities, which is, you know, the work that I have been focusing on. And its ability to merge tradition with innovation, it's not only relevant, but also vital for storytelling and connecting with diverse audiences. So as printmaking continues to evolve, it still has that historical component to it, which reminds me of like its enduring power to make art accessible and amplifying voices that otherwise may go unheard.
It's interesting because I think most of us would recognize printmaking when we see it, but wouldn't necessarily understand the labor or work that goes into it to create these pieces of art. In the same way, you could say we see the fruits of labor, but not necessarily the migrant laborer's work that goes into what comes to our grocery store and into our kitchen. What's the connection you see between your work and the workers that you feature?
In my practice, labor is not just like a subject or a theme, but it's also part of the process. So I choose to render these stories through printmaking, which is a medium that in itself is very labor intensive. The process of carving a relief block or graining a lithostone requires immense skill and precision and physical exertion, and it can place a strain on the body, from rolling out slabs of ink with heavy rollers to the repetitive motion of inking and running a piece through the press. And I mean, the labor behind it, creating each print, mirrors for me the physicality and dedication of the work carried out by the people that I seek to honor. So the connection between my artistic process and the work of laborers becomes more evident when reflecting on their skill and experience and expertise. And I'm going to give you an example here. So during my interviews that I would have with some of these labor workers out in Washington State, there was a particular worker in a farm out in Zilla, and it was during cherry picking season, and he was demonstrating to me like the careful and strategic technique that was required to pick cherries properly off of a branch. He explained that one must be quick and precise while taking care of to not only damage the tree, but making sure that that he doesn't damage it, because in damaging it, it could reduce the tree's fruit production for the following year. So his explanation highlighted the skill and the knowledge embedded in his work. And these are people that are very highly skilled in what they're doing. And that's something that is often overlooked and undervalued.
We're talking about the art of printmaking with Christy Tirado, a Mexican-American interdisciplinary artist and educator whose work highlights the stories of migrant laborers, and she's currently enrolled in the MFA printmaking program at UW-Madison. And as you mentioned, Christy, your most recent projects are focusing more on your own family and your family history, including your dad. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Yeah, so my father immigrated in the 70s from Mexico, and he worked in he traveled around the country seeking just different jobs. And I ended up creating a print about him called Historias y Granadas. And his story is a story that's very similar to a lot of migrant families' stories. So do you want me to tell a little bit about the print?
Yeah, I'm looking at the print right now, and it is a beautiful relief that is centered on a migrant laborer that's your dad?
Yes, so my dad's in the center, and he's holding a pomegranate, and he's sitting on a eucalyptus trunk, and around him is just like this, like a bunch of different flowers and pomegranates and just designs that kind of encapsulates him and really puts him at the center, and to honor him and his story.
You have him in a stark black and white relief. You have a little orange butterfly on his hand where he's holding the pomegranate. But then all around him is this beautiful blue and red flowering and budding fruits. There's a lot of life here. There's motion in this. How do you create motion from a print, Christy?
The print and I guess the accompanying story of my father's story and the labor that has paved the way for him and me to live that American dream is just like, for me, it was evident to really create this movement and invoke it through the piece. So in this work, I, by creating all of these different designs, I really want to highlight the resilience and dedication and the sacrifices embodied in his hands, which have been weathered with a lifetime of labor, going across borders and into different job industries. Like I mentioned, his journey is not just a personal narrative, but it's also like a collective testament to the struggles and triumphs of immigrant workers who have given their lives to build foundations, both in literal and metaphorical senses, for the next generation, which is for myself and my siblings.
Christy, you've also have written a piece to go along with the artwork, Historias y Granadas, that is Las Manos de mi Padre, The Hands of My Father. Can you read a little bit of that for us?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Las Manos de mi Padre. As the Saturday afternoon sun gently caressed his tejana, el canto de los gallos pierced the ambience, blending seamlessly with the comforting aroma of la tierra and burning firewood, weaving a tapestry of all too familiar memories. A soft breeze carried the fallen leaves of the pomegranate tree, circling the eucalyptus trunk where he was seated. As he delicately peeled back the skin of the granada, revealing the tiny garnets within, I watched him, as he gently plucked each seed, making sure not to apply too much pressure to prevent them from bursting. Una por una, one by one, some of the semillitas found their way into the palm of his hand, while others danced away, falling into the tierra beneath our feet. As I observed his tender precision, memorias escritas en sus manos seemed to sprinkle out. However, unlike the seeds that were falling onto the floor, I was catching these memories, recalling the countless times I witnessed esas mismas manos come home from work, weathered, tired, and aching from the countless jobs he's had to do to live the American dream.
Hmm. Your piece goes on from there and talks about esas son las mismas manos, and the rough translation mm-hmm. is that these are the same hands, and it goes through
yes.
all the work that your father has done. Was it easier for you to tackle the migrant laborers in Yakima Valley through your art or your own family history through your art? And what did you get out of exploring that?
You know, I don't know if either of them were easy. I feel that as you're stepping into the realities of other people, sometimes people are very guarded with those memories and those histories. And it does require a lot of relationship building to be able to step into these worlds and be able to collect and extract some of this information to be able to also, you know, and also the weight that it carries with them and creating a piece that, you know, shows that weight, but also really honors these stories in a dignified form can be quite heavy.
Yeah. And the lack of visibility that we started with discussing about migrant labor is sometimes when you want to make them visible, there can be some skepticism there about why and what the intentions are, and it would be completely understandable.
Right.
So what projects are you working on now, Christy?
Yeah, so right now I'm focusing on creating a new body of work that similar to the piece that we just discussed about my father. I'm really digging deeper and I'm searching for these different histories and these stories that have gone untold within my own familial background. And I really want to bring those to light with a lot more narratives, not just in a printed form, but also in a written form, so people can connect with it in multiple levels. So that's essentially what I'm working on now.
And where would people be able to find the work of Christy Tirado?
So as of now, I am going to have a solo exhibition at Tandem Press in March, and this is for my MFA qualifier show. So the dates will be posted at a later time for that. But I'm also going to have a solo exhibition at the Yakima Valley Museum in Yakima, Washington in the summer.
Christy Tirado, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that was Lee Rayburn talking with Christy Tirado, a Mexican-American interdisciplinary artist and educator who specializes in block printing and uses her work to tell the stories of migrant laborers, including her own father. In recent days, Governor Tony Evers announced he wants to revive a plan to let voters repeal and create state laws without the state legislature's approval. And we want to hear from you on this. What do you think about a citizen-led referendum process? Should Wisconsinites have the ability to gather signatures to bring forward statewide ballot measures? And if so, what policy issue would you attempt to put before voters? Let's hear from you about the pros and cons of such proposals. Share your thoughts on creating the ability for voters to enact policies and what that would mean for the Wisconsin Constitution. Email us your thoughts at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can call or text us to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.